Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
Taylor Anderson is a journalist. He tracks Utah's housing market, which is really weird right now. Screwy, as he put it, as you'll hear. If you just take his own experience looking for a house, you'll see what he means. Because he and his wife went through all of these shifts over the years. From the time when there were these rock-bottom interest rates and a wave of people moving into the state that heated up the market and competition got intense, buyers were in bidding wars, and then interest rates started to spike and everything changed. And meanwhile, the rental market was moving too. A massive wave of new apartment construction has added thousands of units, and in some areas, rent is starting to cool. And for Taylor, his experience reveals that contradiction that defines this moment, a system that feels like it's shifting underneath everyone.
I moved here in January of 2017 for work, and a friend who moved here before I did bought a place. When I was talking to him, I was like, "You're crazy. Who can afford to buy a house?" And he said, "Actually, in Salt Lake, it's cheaper to buy a house than it is to rent." And it was true. At the time in 2017, it was less expensive to pay a mortgage each month than it was to pay the area cost of rent. So we bought a place in Salt Lake City's Liberty Wells neighborhood. Everybody knew each other, which was great. But in March of 2020, COVID was shocking the U.S. and the world. And we abruptly shifted from working in office every day to working at home. And that paired with a decision to start having kids, we kind of realized that something had to give and we needed more space. So that sent us on a search for a bigger house. Between 2021 and 2022, when the real estate market in Salt Lake City and across the country was hotter than it ever has been in history and probably ever will be since, we made, I'm guessing, 15 offers. Many of them over asking price. And we got outbid on almost every one of them. Man, it sucks because you get attached to each house. And losing 15 times really stings. You're like drained emotionally. And each time you have to go back to the drawing board, back to square one, and start the process all over again. Eventually, the desire to live in a walkable area was so strong that we ended up moving out of state. We moved to Chicago, and I viewed it as an opportunity to see what it would actually be like to live in a very walkable place. We lived there for about 2 years before coming back and deciding to rent in the East Liberty Park neighborhood. And the theory was that if we kind of ingrained ourselves in the neighborhood and met the neighbors and, you know, were our true selves, we would hopefully hear of somebody that was going to put their house on the market and maybe we'd be lucky enough to meet them and make an offer and move into their house, buy it. And luckily, that's what seems to be happening right now. Yeah, we're under contract to buy a house kitty corner to the one that we're renting now and set to close at the end of May. When I moved to Salt Lake City in January of 2017, it was less expensive to buy a house than it was to rent a house, and that flip has completely changed. It probably costs at least $1,000 a month more on average to buy a house now than to rent an apartment or rent a house. Something totally screwy has happened in the U.S. real estate market, and we're living through it. My wife and I unfortunately lived through that over the past 5 years, but I feel grateful. We've been lucky, and the future looks good.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're trying to make sense of this unique moment in Utah housing. By some measures, we've been building at a remarkable pace. You've probably noticed the surge in apartment construction all across the valley. And yet for many people, the experience on the ground hasn't really caught up. Housing still feels out of reach. Single family homes are still scarce and hard to compete for. And then on top of that, there's a different kind of concern that's coming up about what all of this new building is doing to the city itself. These big apartment projects are going up quickly in so many places and are raising these questions about how Salt Lake looks and feels and whether that change is good or just too much, too fast. Taylor Anderson is our guest for the hour. He's editor-in-chief of Building Salt Lake. It's an online news outlet that covers real estate and development in the city. He's also a reporter for Inman News. It's a real estate industry trade publication. It's a very particular type of journalism that you do. Why? What interests you about all of this?
I think it started because Salt Lake and Utah in general have been growing so rapidly since my arrival here. And since then, and even before, Utah has been on the map for growth. And part of that is macro factors. Part of that is intervention from the legislature of saying we're going to be growth at all costs. We're going to support the economy, a diverse economy. We're going to bring jobs. We're going to bring people. We're going to just grow. And that has set the stage for the built environment changes that people notice on their day-to-day, right? They leave their house, they see a new building, they see a new apartment complex, they see a new strip mall, whatever it might be. They notice change that's happening, and that's fascinating to me. I mean, the building blocks that make up the block, the street, the neighborhood, the entire city, the region, the state, like when you're changing, when you're growing, like that is impacting everyone. And it's just something that once I entered the rabbit hole, like I just, it's a slippery slope to be like, okay, like what is behind those building blocks? So like who is writing the rules, who is following the rules or bending the rules or trying to remake the rules, and who is impacted by all of that? It's really all of us. So it's really, you know, one niche within journalism that I can't ignore because nobody else is ignoring it. Everyone is feeling it. If you live in the city, if you live in this region, you know that change is a constant and it's happening very quickly. So I just think it's a beat that's, you know, underserved and also just fascinating because of the impact that everyone has.
We'll get to this, but I think what's interesting about covering this subject is there are the basic sort of economic forces that you have to pay attention to. But then there's something that's more subjective in some ways, or certainly more abstract, and that is the quality of life, like the aesthetic part of the question of living in a place, green space, open space, walkability, all those kinds of things that are less about – I mean, they're connected to economic forces, but they're also something that is so subjective. And I guess you have to take that into are you interested in that as well, I guess?
Of course, because it's also a moving target, right? Cities are seeing these trends happening in real time and they have to respond. And that's not a quick process because then you have to engage the public. Then you have to go through that process, rewrite the rules, you know, put up drafts. You know, we're adding jobs, so that means more people are going to come. So that means we need X, Y, and Z. So how do we get that? How do we pay for that? It's not easy. And yes, like what makes a place livable for whom is all part of it. I mean, it's kind of, again, urbanism is like what are the building blocks that make up a city and a region and a place that we all live in. And yes, it's in all of the above, you know, transit, driving, right? How many lanes are on the road? How wide are the sidewalks? You know, what are the rules? What are the design standards for the buildings themselves? Where are the schools? How big are they? How small are they? You know, do you have to drive to them? It all is part of that. You know, I say I cover commercial real estate, but also I cover urban planning and just placemaking. The built environment in general is kind of a catch-all phrase, and it includes everything you mentioned and more.
Do you think that government can ever keep pace with the growth and development and building? Which is to say, it seems like when the regulations come or when the policies come, the building's been done. So is that a challenge for planners to get developers and people who need a house or an apartment to say, hold off a minute, let's think about this before we start digging holes and throwing up buildings?
I think, honestly, to give some credit, Salt Lake City's planning division is doing a great job of being not only reactive but proactive.
So they are thinking about this.
They are. I mean, I think better than any city that I'm aware of in Utah, at least. And really, nationally, like Salt Lake City's planning division needs a lot of credit. And also the administration gives them the leeway to then, again, try to be proactive and try to fix zoning that they believe is broken, I believe is broken, and get ahead of that. And you might not be able to, you know, correct for the building that just opened last week.
Yeah.
But if we know that Utah is going to continue growing, adding millions more people by, you know, the next 2-3 decades, they're going to need to get the rules in place. It's always an ongoing thing. That's the thing with cities that's so fascinating, is that they're always changing. Every single day, somebody's dying, somebody's being born, people are moving here, people are moving out. You know, they're bringing that energy is leaving. It's just always the state of change. And, you know, if you're growing, I think it's a good problem. You know, it's obviously frustrating, especially I think people that grew up in a place have stronger opinions on the matter than imports, than, you know, people that just moved to a place or moved.
Because you're ruining the place, right? I mean, you hear that a lot, right? Like, this is the way it used to be and don't mess with it. And I guess you have to contend with that all the time.
I mean, that's you know, the state of economies. It's trading ideas, borrowing from a place that, you know, people generally like, and getting rid of ideas that they, you know, maybe weren't working. And again, I mean, back to your original question, I think it is hard. I mean, it is hard. It is a mix of reacting to what people are what the broader public does not like, and trying to tap into what they're saying, because you're never going to get a consensus, right? You're never going to hear 100% of people want buildings to look like this, right?
Right.
I think some cities are doing it right. I think some cities are doing a pretty good job of blocking new development. And when I say pretty good job, we would need to delve into what they're blocking and the ramifications of those. I think the state, the legislature, is starting to listen and hear, like, whether they need to intervene and push cities a certain way or pull them another way. But I do think Salt Lake City, by and large, is getting it right. And I think there's going to be a lot of opinions on that statement based on people's personal take on the maybe past 10 years of how the city has changed.
Well, there's a very strong private property, private, you know, property rights ethic in this state that's always been there. And I'm guessing that's one of the obstacles you're getting at there.
It is. And I think Salt Lake City would do more. I think they would respond to, and we haven't even talked about, you know, people, you know, always talk about, let's say 400 South as being a corridor that has seen a lot of change.
Yeah.
And I think people going to the U see it every day because they're driving or taking tracks up and down 400 South, and they see all these new buildings that have gone up, and they have opinions on, is that a nice looking building or not? Is it offering enough to the public or not? I think the city might do more, if not for that sense that the legislature would intervene and usurp Salt Lake City's land use authority if it goes too far in one direction or another when it comes to dictating what happens on private property. So yeah, that's it. Utah, by and large, is a very strong state on that front.
I guess that gets me to how it is you deal with the interplay between people's impressions and the actual data, because I'm guessing you hear a lot. You just mentioned 4th South. There are a lot of, I'll just put it this way, anecdotal impressions that people have. I mean, we all have them. People talk about it at dinner and, you know, at dinner parties and stuff like that. It's like there are so many apartment buildings being built in this city. And is anyone paying attention to all of these buildings? Is it too much? Is it what's it doing to the city? There are too many of them here. We've overbuilt. All of those kinds of things that I'm sure you hear. How do you what do you make of that, I suppose, in comparison to the actual data that's there? Do those things actually match up?
I mean, I see it anytime we write a story about a new project. Let's just say multifamily, right? We say a new apartment project is proposed in Sugar House, and all of the comments online are that, oh, look, another apartment building that's going to be vacant that nobody can afford.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, you know, you have to be reasonable with your response. Often I just ignore those. And somebody would be taking a $100 million bet on a building sitting vacant, right? Nobody's going to make that bet. That's not actually happening. Our vacancy rate is around 5%. It's always in flux, but it's around 5%. A new building that opens up is going to take months, maybe 6 months, 8 months to get anywhere near pretty much occupied. I think that's outside of that 5% that I mentioned.
Yeah.
But the notion that people are just going and spending hundreds of millions of dollars. They're getting loans from banks that must turn a profit or they're failing, right? And then the building just didn't actually need people. It's not actually – nobody wants to live there. Like that
– like no one did a business analysis or a market analysis on
that's
that.
Just not how the industry works. Because otherwise a lot of people are failing and a lot of people are losing money.
But what do you make of the fact that they're saying that? Because you say, well, you know, you just sort of what are you going to – how are you going to respond to that? But you do hear it a lot. And so where is that coming from people, do you think?
I think – it's again like when you're a fast growing region, there's a lot of angst, right?
Yeah.
Sugarhouse didn't used to look like this.
Yep.
I don't want it to look like this. Like I can't – I feel powerless. These are the readers. These are the residents that feel like they can't influence what is happening to the place that they knew and used to look a different way.
Right.
And I do think there's like a national misconception that – developers can do whatever they want. They're going to do whatever they want despite what the local rules say, and they're just going to put up these buildings that can stay vacant, and somehow people are going to make money and just keep doing this. Again, you need to be patient. You need to understand where they're coming from, which is that angst of whether it's your hometown or your adopted town, Salt Lake City, right? You just know that people are going to feel so many different emotions when you live in a high-growth area that – I get it. That's coming from, again, the mix of that national misconception that this is happening and that BlackRock or Blackstone are really behind it and that they own everything and that you can't stand up to BlackRock, so you've got to vent your frustration somewhere else. That is not happening in Salt Lake City, and that's why you can find an apartment downtown for roughly half price for the year, because these owners can't afford to have a building sit vacant. They need to offer you something to entice you to sign a lease to live in that building. And right now, at least recently downtown, that has meant you can live for half off downtown or close to it.
Say more about that. You've talked about they're offering like gift cards and financial incentives and all kinds of things. What does that say about the market right now?
We are overbuilt downtown. Yeah. I mean, some submarkets like downtown, they – due to macro factors like the historically low interest rates, free money, right? You've got – you find an area that could be developed under the zoning rules if you're a developer. Go out and find people that are willing to write a check to make a bet on that property. You know, they're lending on 0% interest, and there's all the COVID. There were different macro things that the migration trends were getting shaken up. Salt Lake City was looking extremely appealing to people that were looking to get out to maybe escape a market that – or a city that had more onerous COVID restrictions. And, you know, Salt Lake City was a bright spot. And it all led to just this like hyper intensive period of development from, say, it was already starting before COVID hit, but then COVID really put the throttle down. And now those projects take a while to get through entitlements, which means getting approval from the city to allow you to move forward with that project, to, you know, lining up the financing, to getting the construction done. Those projects have only recently been being completed. And so they do open up like the new high rises in the middle of downtown, right? They open up and those developers and property managers are now competing with each other to fill them up, because depending on which project we're talking about, they're either trying to stabilize, which means get enough renters within so that there's not a high vacancy rate in that building and then sell the building, or it's a long-term holder and they don't want to – people want their buildings full if you build them.
Yep.
And we just happen to have a period based on those macro factors where developers were all in, just moving as fast as they could to get a project out of the ground, and it led to just this convergence of a lot of new buildings in the middle of downtown, and that led to a period where it's very good if you're a renter and willing to move, and a lot harder if you're trying to fill up those buildings and they had to get creative around – how they were getting people into the buildings.
So why doesn't that confirm the suspicion of the person who commented on one of your stories that, oh, they're just going to build a building that's going to sit vacant? What you're saying is they're building the building, yes, but they're going to lower the rent to get you in there.
That's tough because they're not always lowering the rent. Rent, by and large, is falling slightly.
But what you just said was we're overbuilt.
Mm-hmm.
That does seem to confirm the suspicion of people who are seeing a lot of buildings and like, who's going to go into these buildings?
Mm-hmm. I guess they're, it's just competitive. You're going to steal from this building down here by offering these incentives. Now this renter moves from Sugar House maybe to the middle of downtown. I mean, it's
– So you're saying this is good for consumers?
If you're in the rental market and you're willing to move, moving stinks. But if you're willing to move, things are very good. You can play the different property managers off each other because it's very competitive to be trying to fill a building. Back to your thought about the concern or the suspicion that all these buildings are vacant. Again, historically, there's always – when buildings are new, it takes a period of time to rent them out. And we're basically in that time right now. As far as stabilized buildings, which means they've been built and maybe they're a year and a half to 2 years old, the vacancy rate is historically pretty low.
Pretty stable too.
Yes, yes. And we're in that period where we had a bunch of new supply, which you know, there's people who say, why don't we just make that homeless housing, you know, a place for people experiencing homelessness or something else. I wish that could be the case. That's just not how the market works, unfortunately. But we're in a very normal period, except for the fact that we have more apartments than we typically have.
Taylor Anderson, he's editor-in-chief of Building Salt Lake. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today we're talking about the Utah housing situation and the contradictions that seem to be defining it right now. On one hand, there's been this boom in apartment building that's added thousands of new places to live. But then housing, especially single-family homes, are still in short supply. And then at the same time, there's this aesthetic element. The physical city is changing. A new kind of Salt Lake is taking shape, which is raising the question of whether all of this growth is altering the look and the feel of the city itself. So we reached out to the housing journalist Taylor Anderson to talk us through all of this. Let's get back to the conversation. How do you describe the Utah housing market? Just generally, I'm thinking like compared to other housing markets in the country. Is it different here? I mean, everyone likes to think that they're distinctive and different. You know, you often hear that, like, well, it's different here. Is it? Is it interesting and different in different ways?
I have a unique perspective on this because I did move to Chicago a couple of years ago. And so I did live in a different type of housing market. The similarity was that it's hyper-competitive in both places. I'm looking in certain areas that are very walkable. And at a certain point, I said, all right, you know what? My wife got a job offer. You know, it was in Chicago. I said, let's go live in a very walkable neighborhood in Chicago and feel like what that's like and observe, again, as a student of the city, like learning like what makes cities tick and what makes them different and the same. Let's go live in one of those neighborhoods. And what was different in Chicago compared to here is there's a lot more housing variety, a lot of different types of housing that build those neighborhoods. I'm talking 2, 3, 4 unit houses. From the outside, they look just like, you know, a house.
Right.
On the inside, there might be 8, 10, 12 people living in there because there's multiple different units, and that gives different people different varieties to choose from. It might match their budget better than if they were all big single family houses.
Right.
Utah, especially Salt Lake City, but I think this applies to most towns and cities across Utah, limited historically and continue to limit that housing optionality. Of, I call it missing middle housing. It's those types between the bigger apartment buildings along 400 South and the towers downtown and the single family house. It's
there's everything. Something about the establishment that doesn't like that.
I think there's certain towns in Utah that would prefer to have a large single lot with a high earning family living there versus having a variety of housing types. Yeah.
Yeah. Why do you think that is?
We're in a weird time where there are certain conspiracies around, you know, whether there's a push, this like global push to have more people living in a certain area, like this concept of a 15-minute city where all of your needs or most of your needs can be accomplished on foot or on a bike or on a train or on a bus without having to spend hours doing it, right? Yeah. Going to the grocery store, going to the park, going to the school, whatever you might be doing, getting to work. That notion has taken root, I think, in Utah more than in other markets. And it's kind of disconcerting to see because there have been success stories. Daybreak is a great example of a place, a new town, a master plan development that is pretty substantial in its size and scale that has a wide variety of housing types. Daybreak stands out as a very walkable, very attractive to families place that, you know, they're adding out the commercial, the retail, the components that will actually allow those residents to stay and not have to drive downtown or to a nearby town to accomplish their tasks. But I think it's few and far between.
You're saying that works, that Daybreak as a concept seems to be working.
Oh, yeah. I think if you're an urbanist, like I consider myself, if you want neighborhoods that are made up of different housing types that give different people, that break down the economic segregation and allow a single person or a young family or, you know, a family looking for their first place to live, whether to rent or buy, there are options in Daybreak. And this is going to read like a Daybreak commercial, but it's really like credit to the developers and the designers that, back to your original question of thinking of what makes a community, you know, a community that people want to live in. I think Daybreak is a great example of that. There's, if you want to live in a townhouse, they've got it. If you want to live in a condo, they've got it. If you want a big single family house, you can get that there as well.
What do you make of the reaction that I'm sure you hear about Daybreak, that it's Disneyfied, it's antiseptic, it's kind of anodyne? Like, do you hear that kind of? Because I do, and I'm wondering what you make of that.
I used to share that as well before I actually went there.
Huh.
I think my only issue with Daybreak right now is that my network, my community is so far removed from that physically.
Yeah.
If not, I would give it a hard look tomorrow. I think, you know, the more you look at what makes that community what it is, where I saw one stat, 80%+ of kids walk or bike to school. That is a dream. Having families move there and have kids be independent enough, or even if they're walking with a parent, like that used to happen in neighborhoods across the country, and it increasingly does not happen. And if they're achieving that in Daybreak, I don't care if it's Disneyland or not. People are living there. That's their daily lives.
I think people's nostalgia is triggering right now because they had to bike to school. You know, they didn't get rides to school.
Or got to. I mean, yeah, that's like,
right.
I think back and I'm like, some of my best memories are me and my buddies doing maybe something we shouldn't do on the way to school.
Totally, yeah.
Right? And it was just the norm. And that was, I'm 37. I grew up, I was born in 89, you know, and it was very normal. It wasn't, right now, if I let my kid walk to Emerson Elementary and somebody sees them, now, she's not old enough to do this, but that's the dream that I would like to see happen. Yeah. It's not uncommon in other states. I think this is something that Utah is maybe getting a little bit right, but it's not uncommon for a parent to stop and say, where's your mom? Where's your dad?
Yeah.
Where are your parents? Why are you alone outside of the house? Like, you know, I think we're on a tangent, but I think like there's certain things that used to make communities a place and used to be norms that I think, again, certain places, Daybreak, again, not a Daybreak commercial, but people are living their lives in a way that I think a lot of people get nostalgic about, dream about returning to. And, you know, if we can recreate that in Salt Lake City and abroad, that's a win in my book.
Could you recreate that in Salt Lake City with the current conditions, the zoning, just the cultural pressures, all of the things? Doesn't seem ready.
This is what's maybe disheartening or the most urgent and pressing need for the city to wrap its arms around and try to correct. I'm sure you remember just a few years ago, we closed 4 elementary schools and the projections for enrollment are bleak. Yeah. I mean, in Salt Lake City proper, and if you look at Mill Creek, they're going through the same thing. If you're looking at, you know, suburbs across the valley, they're looking at, oh my goodness, like families are going somewhere and it's not here. They're leaving.
Yeah.
And I think I have seen from, you know, people who know much more than I do that the lack of housing optionality, housing options paired with the housing affordability problem, which those go hand in hand.
For sure.
You're going to continue to see families either stay away or flee places like Salt Lake City because they're just out of reach. You don't have the option of that condo or that townhouse. Yes, we have some, but I think we're seeing a lot of rentals being built, and I think the city's now just starting to approach the reality that we live in a valley and we're constrained by the lake and the mountains, and we need to, if we're going to grow, we're going to have to grow inward. We're going to have to infill. And the city, Salt Lake City, is entering a period of what will most likely be intense debate around
How do we rewrite our single-family zoning rules in order to allow for the creation of more housing in ways that maybe neighborhoods can stomach and might lead to, you know, more attainable housing options in neighborhoods across the city? That's going to be the most intense debate around housing, I think, in Salt Lake City for the next 2 years.
So it sounds like there's two very different stories playing out. On one hand, just in terms of the scale of building. So if I understand it right, when you're talking about apartments, Salt Lake typically needs something like 2,500 to 3,000 new apartment units a year to just keep up with demand. In recent years, we've gone well above that. Is that right?
Yeah, that's fair. Yep.
How far above that?
Multiple years. I mean, 3 or 4 years of supply coming online at the same time.
Right.
More than we typically get.
And then the question is, which we were sort of talking about, did we overcorrect? Does that mean we overcorrected? Say something about that. I want to move to housing really quickly, but did we overcorrect, do you think?
I think due to macro factors that nobody could control, right? If the interest rates are zero and if the zoning allows and if, you know, enough developers are interested in a place, yes, due to those factors, I think, you know, there was a term that came out in 2024 or 2023 when this issue was becoming clear. We're going to have an oversupply of new apartments in not just Salt Lake City, but in markets that were friendly to new housing supply across the country.
Yeah.
They said survive till 2025, get those buildings full, and then we'll look at the next chapter of how many apartments are going to be built. We're still in that period, and that tagline has changed to something else. Their developers are still trying to figure out how are they going to stabilize these buildings and then get to maybe a more normal period of apartment supply.
So that's one part of the story. It's the apartment part. But it seems like while we've gotten better at building rental housing, we haven't actually solved the problem of people trying to buy a home.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
I think so too. I mean, based on my personal experience, I can tell you if you're like me and you were looking in certain areas that are walkable, that can have a house big enough for our growing family, it's hyper competitive. And I think we've seen the governor, the legislature, some towns realize that they need to intervene. We need more for sale housing supply in order to meet the existing demand and future demand of people moving here and just retaining our families. You see Governor Cox talk about this all the time. He doesn't want his kids or grandkids to go live in Indiana just because that's the place that they could find that's affordable.
Yeah.
We're seeing that all of the Midwest is very attractive right now because so many other places have restricted housing supply so much that housing prices, there's no housing attainability.
Supply always translates to affordability. Like, can your grandkids afford to put a down payment on a house? And with the median price of a single family home in Utah being what?
I'd have to check.
Okay.
It might be $550,000.
Yeah. I mean,
higher in Salt Lake City.
Yeah. I mean, I think the consensus is it's that, or I mean, that's a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So this seems to be the issue, and I guess the question is why? Why is it so much easier to build apartments than it is to build for, you know, housing?
Well, you can add so many more units of apartments on a single lot than you can, you know, you need more space for single family houses. Again, when we talk about housing options, you know, townhouses, you can fit more of those on, you know, an acre parcel than you can fit single family houses. I think by and large, cities, and this isn't just a uniquely Utah problem. This is a nationwide problem of, again, back to you mentioned supply and demand. It's economics, right? So if we have people who want to live here, we have the growth trends of Utah is going to continue growing for the foreseeable future.
Yeah.
That, and we have a limited supply of for sale housing, where something has to give. We're either going to see prices go up at an unattainable amount, or we're going to adjust the rules that are in place, which is zoning, local zoning authority. Each town writes its own rules. And if you're going to require half-acre lots or a third of an acre lot, you're going to have fewer houses built in your town. And some towns might be intentionally trying to do that, and others like Salt Lake City might be intentionally trying to correct for past decisions that restricted supply.
So once you hit that tipping point, then zoning rules are going to have to change. People are going to have to change to make that possible. And it seems like, haven't we hit that tipping point yet?
I would call there's something that I like to call the nuclear option. You know, it's not – it's a cliche, right? The nuclear option in housing in Utah is the legislature stepping in and saying enough is enough.
Yeah.
We can't keep watching our kids and grandkids grow up in the Midwest because we have failed to respond to the ongoing clear market conditions of housing prices keep hitting new records.
Yeah.
And – what's going to stop that from continuing to happen? Are we going to have to wait to see job losses and businesses leaving? Like, that's antithetical to what this legislature wants to happen as well, right? Growth at all costs, continue a diversified, strong, growing economy. That's what the legislature wants, and that's, you know, every step of the way, that's what they do. So that indicates that housing prices aren't going to collapse because, you know, there's going to be more jobs and people will continue to move here. So the nuclear option in housing in Utah is the legislature saying, okay, Draper, Sandy, Harriman, West Jordan, Midway, whatever the town might be, you no longer have the authority to mandate that, you know, a developer must use X amount of space for each X type of house. And usually it's single family houses.
Right.
By and large, most of the valley is zoned for single family houses,
yeah,
and nothing else. Yeah. So if they were to take away that authority, which again would be a pretty drastic step, but it's a step that we increasingly hear Governor Cox mention as an option that he might consider.
Like, the state's going to step in and apply some rigor in terms of zoning for these communities, that it's no longer up to you just as a city. This is a statewide issue. There are economic interests and cultural interests that we find important, and so we're going to step in. How far away would we be from something like that?
We have seen the legislature take what I would call baby steps, but they're meaningful steps toward intervening in local land use authority. The one thing that comes to mind is a few years ago, they passed a bill that allowed any homeowner to build an accessory dwelling unit, a second livable space within their home. It has to be inside. According to that law that was passed a few years ago, this past session, they passed another one that said you can build an external accessory dwelling unit. That means above a garage or a standalone structure in your backyard.
Like a tiny house?
Yeah. Yeah. Huh. Yeah. A second house. And that plays into the for sale affordability piece because, you know, if I'm shopping for a house, which I had been for 5 years, and I'm trying to make the budget work, if I have a rentable space or if I can have an in-law or a sibling or somebody else live on that property as well, whereas before I could only have me and my family, my direct nuclear family, live on that house, it's going to be more affordable in that way. So we've passed those two laws to allow internal ADUs and now external ADUs with some conditions on a ladder. Those are steps that the legislature has indicated that it is moving toward, you know, cities can no longer restrict housing to the extent that they had been. And I think if we continue to see housing prices go up and cities continue to be restrictive on with their zoning rules, with their local land use authority to prevent housing optionality and smaller lots and smaller homes, some cities restrict. They say you must build X size of house. They put a floor on the size of the house that can be built there. That's going to make that house more expensive than if the developer could just build whatever size they think the market's going to respond to.
Well, that's my question, actually. So what's the incentive there? What's driving that regulation? It doesn't seem like it's economic forces. If you're a developer – well, I guess this is the question. If you're a developer, is it bad for you economically, these regulations, or does it just give you more opportunity to build different types of houses? So if it's not economic, if that's the case, and you can tell me, is it then what? Cultural?
It could be cultural. I mean, I think without pointing fingers, right, because I haven't gotten too on the ground to say to study each city council, but I think by and large there are some, and this is in Utah and abroad, but some towns that think, wouldn't it just be great if we had only houses that were 3,000 square feet that all cost over $1 million and – it is only affordable by one type of person.
Yep.
That is creating a walled garden of just wealth, right? Nobody else can live there. And I mean, that is happening in real time in Utah. And that's what's, you know, if you can't build that there, then you can't build that there. Developers can't do anything about it until that zoning rule changes. And so I think, like you said, I think culturally that's a good term to put on it, because that if those cities do exist, they are then electing like-minded representatives to be on the city council, be on the planning commission to enforce or enact those rules, those local land use rules. And I think that's a part of it.
Culture is also a kind of a benign way to put it, and maybe an overly generous way to put it, because you could say it's classist. Mm. You could say it's racist.
I think, again, economic segregation is a real thing.
Yeah.
And zoning is the primary way to enforce, to enact and enforce that. So if you enact zoning that says you can't have duplexes, you can't have triplexes, you can't have, you know, previously you couldn't have ADUs, now you can. It's economic segregation. And I think we're the legislature is slowly, in my opinion, but approaching the point where they might say, we're going to do something about that.
Taylor Anderson, he's editor-in-chief of Building Salt Lake. It's an online news outlet that covers real estate and development in the city. We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from our members. Find out how at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today, we're talking about the contradictions that seem to be defining Utah's housing market right now. A lot of apartments being built, but buying a home is still a stretch for a lot of families. And then there's the other piece to it, what all of this construction is doing to the look and the feel of the city itself. We have with us the housing journalist, Taylor Anderson. I want to come back to the that more abstract part of the conversation, that is the kind of, I guess, the aesthetic question. Because people say, you hear, these new apartments are ugly, they say. They seem like they're cheaply built. They're kind of damaging the character of the city. And the question is, are we trading beauty or something appealing for affordability or just the market forces? And I guess I'm wondering, if somebody says that apartment building is ugly and it's damaging the character of the city, is that fair?
I think it's fair to have that discussion. And if you're trying to have it with me right now, I'm probably more leaning toward I would rather have a city that's accessible to more people than to have this subjective idea of a beautiful looking building. I mean, there are definitely buildings that I think you and I would go walk down and agree that they are stunning. They are beautiful. We could take 10 people and they might all agree.
Yeah.
And yet if the trade-off is my kid grows up and can't afford to live in the city, then what have I done? If I haven't used my voice to advocate for the development of the blocks, the streets, the neighborhoods that make up these cities, you know, that's the debate. Those are the trade-offs. Are these buildings on 400 South beautiful?
Yeah.
I think, you know, if we took 10 people, 7 might agree that they're not. And others might just say, well, the trade-off is the lack of affordability.
Yeah.
It's tough. It's not easy. Back to what we said at the top, which is especially if you grew up here, but if you've spent any meaningful amount of time, you've seen a drastic amount of change, change that you likely won't see in most other cities. But that's just know that that's the line that we're walking. It's density, it's affordability, and it's historic preservation. Those three are always at odds with each other, and not everyone's going to be happy with how things get developed.
You can't find an objective measurement for whether or not a building is ugly or stunning. I get that. But are there objective measures for the number of buildings, the amount of green space, parks, just diversity in terms of the amount of heat that emanates from a city, the amount of just sort of social engagement? I mean, this stuff seems really hard to measure, but so what do you make of that part of the question?
I think that for whatever reason, when you were talking about that, my mind went to the Granary District, which is this area that's southwest of downtown Salt Lake City. Mm. It's about 5th South to 8th South, 3rd West to the interstate. And it's growing rapidly. I mean, they're putting up a new apartment every few months, right? It's not that drastic, but it's growing rapidly. It's changing. And we know that the west side of downtown is underserved by grocery stores. We know that it's underserved by parks. Luckily, the city has found space that it's going to add a new park in that area. But it's back to those, like, being reactive and being proactive. There are certain problems in the city or in the region that you can see a certain area being underserved by X, Y, and Z. You're never going to have a city where you're like, everything's perfect. We got enough parks. We got enough grocery stores over here. We got enough schools over there. Like, it's the process of never-ending change. That's what creates this angst and this, maybe if depending on who you are, this desire to make a change to improve things in one way or the other. I think it's a normal process.
So are you saying that Utah is not always – is not getting it completely right, but it's getting it right enough at times? It's working it out. It's responding. It's you sound – I won't say optimistic, but maybe you do feel that way.
I mean, I do feel that way. If we look at the downtown oversupply of rental housing right now, that I mentioned these macro factors, but leading up to COVID, we were seeing rent go up like crazy. And during COVID, it was going up even crazier. And now rent's going down as a result of the response, as a result of the Salt Lake City Council and mayor's office being pro-housing, pro-development. People said the rent is going up too fast. Look, here we are 4 years later and rent is ticking down. That's going to sound like it's crazy talk to some people who are paying their bills each month. But yeah, truly, we have built enough housing to at least keep a tamp on rent growth that we're seeing in other cities that are still anti-housing. I'm hearing, you know, things from Governor Cox calling for these new, you know, 35,000 starter homes. I'm seeing Salt Lake City again approaching what will be a contentious debate around what our single family housing zones look like, what the rules are within those zones, and whether they're going to allow what we used to allow decades ago, which was if you don't need a big backyard, you can split that lot, sell it, and somebody can build a house there. That was historically the norm, and it's only recently that that was not the norm. And I'm encouraged that I'm hearing those kinds of statements from Governor Cox and initiatives that he has put in place, and the willingness that, you know, the city council has to have what, again, will be a hard debate, and the signals that we've gotten from the legislature to say, hey, look, this is we recognize this as a problem. We're not going to push the nuclear button, but we are going to at least signal to cities that they need to treat it seriously if they don't want to see our kids and grandkids have to live somewhere else due to the lack of affordability. So, I mean, I think generally we are moving in a good direction. I'm optimistic around the housing situation in Salt Lake City by and by. It's just a hard process along the way.
So when you hear someone say in response to having driven by a new apartment complex that's going up and they're like, enough already, we should stop until we figure this out, you respond by saying what?
Do you want prices to continue to go up, or do you want this to be a place for everyone? I tend to want to lower those barriers, not saying that that person is right or wrong. It's just that, yes, change is difficult. Yes, that is change incarnate. But look at the alternatives. You know, are we going to be a walled garden, or are we going to be a welcoming place that if you want to live in Salt Lake City, or if you want to live in Draper, or if you want to live in Utah at large, you have options? I would take the latter over the former.
What do you think this city's going to look like in 10 years?
I think there will probably be more noticeable change outside of Salt Lake City. My mind first goes to the Wasatch back from Park City to Heber.
Yeah.
I'm a little bit afraid of what it's going to look like, to be honest. In general, I'm more pro-walkability and less car dependency. And when we build new highways to, you know, unlock new access to places, we're going to get more sprawl and more, again,
more traffic.
I mean, it's because you don't have the option to do your errands outside of a car. You know, if you live 3 miles from school, your kid's probably not going to walk to school in elementary school. If you have to go drive to the grocery store and then drive to whatever errand you're doing, sprawl requires that. That induces more congestion, and then it creates the conception in the public's mind that we must build more roads to then address the sprawl that was created by the roads and sprawl that created the congestion. So I'm afraid for the Wasatch back. I think that's going to look like more or less one large subdivision with pockets of maybe identity in between here and there. I think we will continue to sprawl. I think Salt Lake City will more or less look the same. I don't expect the skyline to change much more than it has to this point, with maybe a few exceptions, maybe a couple new buildings. But at this point, it's not going to meaningfully change the skyline compared to recent changes that we've seen. It's hard to say if we're going to unlock the changes that are going to lead to more walkable and more welcoming towns outside of Salt Lake City between now and, let's just say, the Olympics. It's hard to say.
Taylor Anderson, thank you very much.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
That's Taylor Anderson. He's editor-in-chief of Building Salt Lake. We'll put a link to that on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on Instagram at Radio West. We're on YouTube at KUER 90.1. You can also email us at radiowest@kuer.org. Our intern is Aidan Oneida, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.